Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank the Perimeter Institute and very in particular Salim for this kind invitation to give a talk. So the title of my talk is on the computation of Poisson brackets in field theories. And what I will be describing is work done in collaboration with Marc Basquens, Bogart Diaz, and Eduardo Villasenor. We wrote a paper on this. I will give you the reference at the end. So this is a summary of my talk. I will start with motivation for follows. Then I will say something about configuration spaces for field theories. After that, I will talk about the phase space of a field theory. I will introduce Poisson brackets. I will discuss some issues related to differentiability. And then I will actually study some concrete examples in Sobolev spaces, which is the kind of configuration spaces that I will consider in this talk. So our motivation to look at this was the Horemheb flux algebra loop quantum gravity, because this involves distributional objects. So you know that instead of working with connections and the density trias as basic variables, what you do is work with fluxes and holonomies, which are defined on surfaces or on graphs. And of course, when you try to compute the Poisson bracket of these kind of things, you must be careful. So in practice, you really need to perform some kind of regularization procedure, or otherwise you get in trouble. Okay, for example, if you look at the original paper by Asteca, Corici, and Zapata, where they started talking about these things, there were some apparent violations of Jacobi identities, which actually originate from the fact that you have to work with distributions. So that can be a little bit dangerous, okay? So one of the lessons that, that I want to convey is that if you want to make rigorous computations, you have to be careful with some functional analytic issues, okay? And actually this is not only in the context of gravity, but I think that this may be the case for all field theories. And in particular, this is very relevant if you work with in manifolds with boundaries, okay? So the kind of problems that we have in mind is how to rigorously work with Poisson brackets when you have either this kind of objects like the holonomies and fluxes, and also you have boundaries in your spatial manifold. Now, a few words about configuration spaces. If you have a mechanical system, usually the configuration space is a finite dimensional differentiable manifold, okay? In the case of field theories, the configuration spaces are usually taken as spaces or regular enough functions defined on some special spatial manifold, and the specification of what the regular thing is often just amounts to saying that, well, the fields are as smooth as needed. For example, in order to be able to plug them into the field equations, we usually involve differential operators, okay? Now, you really need to be more careful because in the case of infinite dimensional manifolds, there are some other structures that you have to specify. Whereas you model every finite dimensional manifold on an Rn with the standard topology, if you really want to work in infinite dimensions, then, for example, there you are in a Banach space, the norms are not all equivalent. So you really need to specify the norm, okay? So these topological issues, which are not relevant in, for mechanical systems, become relevant in the case of field theories, okay? And this is not a matter of mathematical rigor. Sometimes you really need to specify these things carefully just to be able to do the computation. And in order to illustrate that, I will use Sobolev spaces as configuration spaces in my talk, and you will see that the details of the scalar product that you may introduce there are really very important in order to get everything right. Phase space. Well, Lagrangian dynamics is defined in the by introducing a real function in the tangent bundle of the configuration space. And then once you have that, from this Lagrangian, you can build the action by as a real function on a space of paths in the configuration space. As we all know, the stationary points of the actions give you the physical evolution of the system, and you can, the condition that gives these stationary points is the Euler-Lagrange equations. Now, Hamiltonian dynamics takes place in phase space, which is a Cotangent bundle of a configuration space. And then in this Cotangent bundle, you have a point in your configuration space, the fibers are dual vector spaces to the fibers that you have in the tangent bundle. And this duality is crucial, and it's crucial to understand this correctly, because the elements of these duals play a very important role, okay? So one of the things that it's important to keep in mind is that in finite dimensional manifolds, the duals are very simple, but in the infinite dimensional case, it's richer and more subtle, as I say here. Now, if you are in a phase space, if you are in the Cotangent bundle of the configuration space, you have, for example, a mechanical system, then there is a canonical symplectic form. This is a two form, which is closed and only generic. Closed just means that exterior differential that I'm in order to show that to denote that I'm in phase space, I am using this fat D. That means that closed means that just the exterior differential is zero. And then non-degeneracy means that basically the symplectic form can be inverted in a complete sense. Now, the standard way of looking at these things in the finite dimensional case is that if you introduce some coordinates on the configuration space, you can, of course, expand one forms and differential forms in terms of the basis furnished by the differentials of the coordinates, okay? So in terms of these objects, you can write, at least locally, the symplectic form as this sum that I am writing here, qi dp, standard thing. This can be interpreted also in the following way, which is completely equivalent. If you give me two vector fields in this phase space that you can expand in like this and like this, you can now compute the action of the symplectic form on these two these fields, vector fields, and it's given by this expression, which is bilinear in the components of the fields, okay? Now, there is a very interesting way of reinterpreting the previous expression, which is the following. Of course, if you are at a point in the phase space, this point can be interpreted as a pair, xp, where x is just a point in the dual configuration space, and p is a covector, is an element in the dual of the fiber at x, okay? Now, if you have a vector which sits at a point in the phase space, this vector can also be interpreted as a pair consisting of two things, a vector in txq, and then a covector in the cotangent in this fiber here. Now, when you take this into account, you can rewrite the action of the symplectic form on two vector fields in the following way. It's just one of these covectors, say the y covector on p, yp acting on xq minus xp acting on yq, okay? Now, this is standard mechanics. Now let's see what happens with field theories. So the usual way we used to think about field theories is, well, you just generalize whatever happens in finite dimensions in as usual. So for example, you rewrite this sum here as an integral in which you change the indices and turn them into some continuous things and you integrate, okay? And then of course you integrate on the manifold where the fields live. So this is the usual way that we think about these objects. However, if you think about it a little bit more, then you realize that this doesn't make much sense. For instance, just to see why this there is something fishy here, one could wonder what is the measure that you should put here in the integral. Is this the Lebesgue measure? Is this any other measure? Is this an extra element that I have to put in by hand? Now, the answer to this is known. And actually, the correct way to think about this problem for fields is just to use the same expression that I have written here, the one with the star, and generalize and take it exactly as it is for field theories, okay? And this is this appears in standard books. For example, if you look at this book by Marsden, Applications of Ground Analysis in Mathematical Physics, this is actually the way you write the action of the symplectic form in the infinite dimensional case, okay? So what you see from here is that as long as you have a good description of covectors in the fibers, then you can just use the same formulas as in the finite dimensional case, but they must be generalized in this way, okay? Now, Poisson brackets and Hamiltonian vector fields. Now I will be talking about field theories. Now, there are some difficulties that you may have there, but if you work on Banach manifolds, model on reflexive spaces, which are those for which the double dual is isomorphic to the space itself. Now, the two form omega, the one that it is given by this expression that I have shown before, is actually close and undegenerate. In that case, we say that it is strongly symplectic or just symplectic. There is also the possibility of having weakly symplectic forms. I will not consider that case here. I will work only on manifolds which, for which the symplectic form is close and undegenerate. In particular, a very good example of these manifolds are those models of Hilbert space. What is Hamiltonian vector fields? Well, if I am in the phase space and I have a differential function, real differential function, the Hamiltonian vector field associated with this function is the unique field that satisfies this equation here, where the I just denotes the interior product, okay? And now if I have two real differential functions in the phase space, the Poisson bracket is defined in this way. It's just the differential acting of F acting on Xt, and that can be rewritten in very in several other ways, okay? By using the derivative or just acting with omega on the Hamiltonian vector fields defined by F and G. Now, this is very easy to see that this Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric, so I can actually rewrite this definition in a different way by flipping J's and S and introducing minus. Okay, that's fine. Now I will talk a little bit about some of the spaces because I will discuss here what happens with Poisson brackets if your configuration space is one of these solver spaces. Now, solver spaces are a particular case of two spaces. I will give you the definition in a second. And strictly speaking, the elements are not functions, but rather equivalence classes of functions. Okay, so I'm generalizing with the physical concept of field, but this is not a very wide generalization. You can define some of the spaces of many types. I will just look at examples in one dimension. In this paper that I written with my collaborators, there are examples also in three dimensions. Sorry, you can really see what changes if you go from one dimension to three dimensions of any type. So let me start with one definition, which is a particular type of some of the spaces that I will use in the examples that I will discuss later. So, Let's suppose that we have an open interval of the real line, which may be bounded or unbounded, and we introduce some space of test functions, which are continuously differentiable real functions with compact support in this interval. Now, we define a space that I call H1 as a space consisting of L2 functions with the additional condition that they are differentiable in some sense. The concrete sense is the following, that there is always an element of L2 such that the integral of U times phi prime can be is equal to minus the integral of G phi, which is what you get by integration backwards, okay? So we say that these functions here in H1 are not only elements of L2, but also their weak derivatives are elements of L2. And I will write
Fernando,
yes.
I have a question. If E, yes, is, if E is bounded, then this integration by parts, you have boundary values. So do you assume there are no
boundaries? Because the functions phi have compact support, so they will vanish at the bottom. Okay. So these are test functions which have compact support on E. Okay.
Even if E is I is compact, but it's compact away from the boundary of I. Okay.
I missed that. May you say that again?
You don't. What happens if I is compact?
It cannot be compact because it's an open.
It's an open interval. Okay, so you I kind of don't understand. Bound. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Bounded means that it can be 1, 2, for example. Okay.
Yeah. No, I understand. Phi is always zero at the boundary. That's what you're saying.
Yes. That's why you take them these functions with compact. Okay. Inside the interval. Okay. Is that clear? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So go ahead. So I will just.
Fernando, sorry. Can I?
Yes.
Yes. Aldo.
Hello.
Is G unique, and in which sense?
It is, okay?
Okay.
It is unique. Here in the definition, it only says that mass is one of these things. Of course, modulo zero measure steps.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
But other than that, it is unique, okay? So I will just show you two or three results which are very useful in this setting. The first one is this theorem, which tells you that with this scalar product, which involves also the derivatives, this space H1 is actually, and of course, using the norm defined by this scalar product, space H1 is a separable field of space. Okay. A second theorem, and this is very interesting, says the following. In this case of this H1 of I, if you take a function here, even if an I can be bounded or unbounded, okay, then there is always a continuous function that I call U twiddle, defined, it is continuous in the closure of I, such that U coincides with U twiddle almost everywhere. And not only that, you have basically the fundamental theorem of calculus there, okay? But here you see that this function is continuous in the closure of I, okay? Now this is very useful because for this particular subnormal space, it doesn't happen for all subnormal spaces, but for this particular one, you have a very useful way of thinking about the elements of this set, okay? These are just some functions which are continuous. Another useful theorem that I will use in the talk is the following. If you have two elements of each one, then the product is well defined, the Leibniz rule holds, and also the formula for integration by parts holds. Okay. As a consequence, we say that this is Banach algebra, and it's good to see that the product of elements in this subnormal space is well defined. So in that sense, this is much better, for example, than working in the space of this. Comments. Of course, there are more general examples of other spaces. You can define these spaces in Rn on manifolds, actually. You can, instead of having one derivative, you can have the derivatives of arbitrary order. Instead of requiring the elements to be elements in L2, they can be elements of Lp, in which case, they are no longer regular spaces, but they are all Banach spaces, okay? So there are many generalizations of this. This example that I'm using here is a very particular example, okay? Now, the fact that the elements of H1 have continuous representatives in the closure of I means that I can actually talk about the values of these functions at any point, even and also in the boundaries, okay? And this is despite the fact that the elements of H1 are, strictly speaking, only defined modulo zero measure sets. Okay? Actually, you can even say more about this continuous representative because it's absolutely continuous. It's differentiable almost everywhere. And the classical derivative coincides with the derivative almost everywhere. So it's even better than continuous. Okay. Now, as I am working now in a Hilbert space, it's very important to have a good characterization of the dual, but this is simple. This is provided by the Fischer representation theorem that tells you that you should have a linear map from the Hilbert space to R. Then F is continuous if and only if there exists a particular element of the Hilbert space such that the action of this functional on any vector is just the scalar product in this Hilbert space with this fixed element that I have here. This element is unique, this psi is unique, and furthermore, the norm of this map is actually very easy to compute because it's the norm of psi in the Hilbert space that there will be. This is very important because this is crucial to characterize in a simple way these duals that I'm introducing that I need to compute the puzzle. Another issue, differentiability and functional derivatives. So let me just remind you what the standard definition of differentiability is in mathematics. So suppose that you have two one-axis spaces with the respective norms. I take an open subset of the first one and I point in this open subset and consider the function from A to the second one-axis space. Now we say that this function is differentiable or shared differential. At this point, if there exists a linear and continuous map that I denote with this fat D, the differential, such that this limit is zero. Okay, this is of course the standard definition. This is the definition that in particular we use in RN multivariate analysis. Okay. Now, properties of this differential, when it exists, it is unique. For example, if you have a linear and continuous function, the differential coincides with itself, obviously. Just have to plug that into the formula and see that the limit is truly zero. And differentiability is a very, very useful concept that allows you to extend many results of analysis to infinite-dimensional Mach spaces and prove very important theorems, such as the inverse function theorem or the implicit function theorem, things like that. So it's really, really a central concept in analysis, okay? And this is, by the way, the kind of differentials that you use to define the theory of derivative differential analysis, okay? So this is the standard thing. Now, when you are working in gravity, there is, people talk about functional differentiability in a very different sense. So if you look at the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian formulation of the field theory in a manifold with boundary, the word differentiability often means the following. You compute the variation of this of functional depending on some fields, and you say that this function is differentiable if this variation can be written as an integral in this way, with no boundary contributions in the right hand side. Okay. Actually, this condition was introduced by Reggie and Tatelboim in a famous paper where he discussed what happened in the asymptotic in the Hamiltonian formulation of gravity when you consider asymptotically flat situations, things like that. And of course, in that setting, this condition is necessary to guarantee that the variational equations that you get from the action do not have boundary contributions that may clash with the boundary conditions. Okay, so there, this kind of condition plays an important role. Okay, but the point that I want to make here is that the standard Fréchet differentiability that you use in mathematics and this vegetative differentiability are concepts that they have very, very, very little in common. Okay, so it's dangerous to, for example, export some of the consequences of Fréchet differentiability to other settings in which differentiability is understood in the second sense and vice versa. Okay, one must really not mix these two things. They are completely different things. One must be very, very careful. Okay, and a situation when this warning applies is precisely the computational Poisson brackets. If you work with field theory defined on a manifold with a bound, okay? So the point is that the relevant differentiability concept to compute by quasi-bracket is a mathematical one. Differentiality is a differentiality. Why use the other? So when you introduce the quasi-brackets, as I did at the beginning of my talk, the other kind of thing doesn't play a role whatsoever, okay? So one must keep that in mind. Now, what happens? What usually happens is that when you use this kind of generalization from mechanics to field theories that I mentioned when I talked about the symplectic form, then you are tempted to generalize Poisson brackets to the infinite dimensional case by writing a formula such as this, okay? In terms of some functional derivatives that look like generalization of the partial derivatives. And then you actually may be tempted to introduce this object here that appears in this radiative of differentiability inside this formula to compute the partial brackets. But as I said at the beginning of my talk, one should remember that the Poisson brackets for fields should be defined in the following way, by considering some covectors in phase space acting, which are actually parts of vector fields defined on this phase space, and use them in this way. So a natural question as well, okay, there is any way to connect these expressions? What is the relation between them? How should we proceed, okay? And how should, is there a way to patch this expression here? So I will tell you how that works in this setting. So for this particular example of the solved space, there is a very natural definition of functional derivative, which is the following. You have a differential function, real function of the solved space, which is a Hilbert space too. The functional derivative that I will denote as capital D psi of F is the unique element of this solid space that satisfies this condition here. And this has a very natural interpretation because the differential is a linear continuous functional. The Ries-Fréchet theorem tells me that it will be represented by some vector in the Hilbert space. So that representative is actually what I call functional derivative here, okay? And I'm doing that because that's actually what allows me to copy in some way the formulas that I showed before, something like, not copy, but write something that looks like, okay? So this is just simple application of the Ries-Fréchet representation of theorem, and this is the natural definition of functional derivative if you are in the solid space. Now, if you do that with a good definition of the Poisson bracket, of the symplectic form, this one here, then you can write the Poisson bracket in this way, in terms of the representatives of these O vectors that I was writing with the all case letters, okay? So this is actually the formula. So now, the only thing I have to do is, if I want to do computations, is, well, introduce partial functional derivatives because I have directions in the field space and the momentum. I have field some momenta, okay? So actually, I do need two types of functional derivatives, which I call d phi and d pi. But this is completely obvious, so just simple exercise, okay? And then when I do that, I get the following formula in a solid space for the Poisson brackets of two functions. It is given in terms of the scalar products in the solid space of these partial derivatives of the two functions of the sphere, which are functions of the physical space. It depends on the field and the moment, okay? Now this formula looks like this formula here, if instead of having this kind of L2 scalar product, if you wish, you use the solid space scalar product and the functional derivatives that I have defined here, okay? So this is the formula that you need to use in this solid space. But this is what comes from the canonical symplectic structure. So I'm not introducing any kind of extraneous elements here. I'm just using the definition of the canonical symplectic form and adapting it to the particular case in which my configuration space is the solid space that I can introduce here. So I will now go and show you some concrete examples of functions in a phase space where the configuration space is solid space, and I will compute Poisson brackets with them. And I will illustrate that even if I have boundaries, everything works very, very well, very easy. So let's take the following configuration space, this H1 of the open interval 0, 1. Okay, so the I that I introduced the definitions at the beginning of the talk, now it's just the open interval 0, 1. Okay. Now I will introduce the first function, which is what I call the evaluation. Now let's take a point in the closure of these, okay? And remember that the closure appears in some of the theorems, in particular the one that told me that I had a continuous representative. And I define the evaluation in the natural way. It's a real function. And what I do is to an element of this solid space, I just compute the value of its representative at the point S, okay? So X is a label. And the evaluation at X is defined by this, okay? And here I'm using this continuous representative that I know it exists. Now, for every function in the solid space, it is possible to show that the evaluation can be written as a scalar product. And in fact, the scalar product is with a particular element of this solid space, which has this expression here, this family expression in terms of hyperbolic cosines and hyperbolic sines. So now this is a complete formula. If you, this is a very nice exercise. If you compute, you take a function in this H1 and you compute the scalar product with this EX, what you get is the value of the function at X, okay? It's an exercise where you have to use some of the results that I showed before, for example, the one talking about integration elements, okay? And it is interesting to see that this EX function here has this interesting symmetry property. EX of Y is the same as EI of X, okay? Very good. So one, actually as a consequence of the previous result, we see that this evaluation is a linear and continuous function. Okay, so it's an element of the dual of H1. Because it's linear and continuous, it's automatically differentiable, and the differential is given by the evaluations. So this is a very simple example. You, once you have this function, you can compute the functional derivative according to the definition that I introduced here. And in this case, it's trivial. The functional derivative with respect to phi here is just ES, the function, the phi function in the hyperbolic cosine, which is independent of phi, okay? In this case, this is very simple. Functional derivative does not depend on the fields. Now, it's interesting to notice that if instead of trying to define the evaluation of the field, you try to define the evaluation of the derivative, then this doesn't work. You cannot do it. Okay, so you can define a function which is the evaluation, but you cannot define a function which is the evaluation of the derivative. Let me now introduce another function in this same solid space. Again, this is a similar function, but this is given by an integral on the interval of the derivative square, which is well defined because phi is an element of this solid space. Okay. Now, this is an interesting example because this function is obviously not differentiable in the gravitational sense. If I try to compute the variation of V and write it as some the integral on the interval of something times the variation of phi, I cannot for several reasons. First of all, because I get some boundary contributions, 0 and 1. And the second reason is that this other term here involves the second derivative of phi, which is not guaranteed to exist for an element of this solid space, in which, in principle, I can only have one derivative, okay? Of course, there are elements in H1 which may be twice differentiable, but generically, they are not, okay? So this function E, which is defined in this set, which has a boundary, is not differentiable in the vegetative sense. However, it is a nice exercise to show that this function is Fréchet differential in the standard sense, and actually the differential has a very simple expression. It is this integral that I'm writing here. You want to do this, you have to check several things. First of all, that it is linear. Second, that it is continuous. And finally, you have to compute the limit that appears in the definition of Fréchet differentiability. And this limit is precisely this one. Okay, you have to check that this is it. Linearity is obvious. Continuity, you just have to remember what the standard characterization of continuity of linear functions in between matched spaces is. And then it's just a simple exercise. So you have to take this absolute value. You can rewrite it in this way. This inequality here is trivial. And then you use the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality to write this final expression here with the two. And then you see that you can identify a constant C, which in this case is twice the norm in this solvable space of phi. Okay, so it is continuous. And finally, you have to check that this limit is zero, but that is also very easy. You have this change of inequalities, so this is the expression that you have to deal with. Of course, if I introduce h squared here inside, I have this other inequality. This is just the square of the norm in H1. So I have the square of the norm divided by the norm. That is just the norm of H. And because the norm is continuous, if I take the limit, when H goes to zero, then I get that the limit of this thing here is again zero. Okay? So this is differentiable in the standard sense. And it is not something mysterious. I mean, it's just simple function. You follow all the steps, and you follow the definition, and you see that it is differential. You can also describe the functional derivative of this function here, and it's very easy to do. For example, you can just see how it looks like by computing the evaluation at any arbitrary point in the interval. This is a very simple exercise where you just use first the fact that the evaluation can be written as a scalar product, then looking at the definition of this functional derivative, which is just the actual differential of E on E, then I use the value of the differential that I have there, and then this can easily be written in terms of this scalar form. So actually you get a complete formula, which is this one, in which again you find this funny hyperbolic cosines and sines there. Okay? So these are functions in H. Now I will go to the phase space, which is H1 times its dual, which is isomorphic to H1 times H1 because of the special representation of here. I can always think of elements in the dual as represented by a vector in the original. Okay. Now I have positions and momenta, so I need to introduce two projections, which are these ones. I call them projection one and projection two. A very simple definition. If I plug a pair of things here, then projection one gives me the first, projection two gives me the second, and I define what I call partial evaluations. So if you give me a function in the phase space, I can either evaluate the first part of the what they get after projecting with the first projector or the second. Okay. Now these functions, which are now defined in this phase space, are real differentiable functions. And this is very easy to see because both the projection and the evaluation are differentiable. And then the partial bracket, for example, of these two functions, pi x and pi y, is given by a formula that I introduced before, which is written in terms of these partial functional derivatives. Okay? So in order to compute, for example, this partial bracket, I just have to compute these derivatives that appear here. That is a very simple exercise. The first, there are two that are different from zero. D pi of pi x is just ex. D pi of pi y is just ey. And the others are zero. So you plug that into the Poisson bracket, what you get is that the Poisson bracket of these partial evaluations is just the function ex of y, okay? And also it's very simple to see that phi x with phi I, phi y, and pi x and pi y for every choice of x and y are zero, okay? So these are the Poisson brackets of these evaluations, and they have the form which is very similar to the usual canonical basic Poisson brackets. And you must understand that they are determined by the canonical symplectic form in this particular phase space. So you just follow the definitions, nothing else, okay? Now, these Poisson brackets, if I had a field theory in this phase space, these Poisson brackets will play the role of the usual ones that we write often when we look at the combinatorial formation of, say, the field theory for the scalar field, with the only difference that you trade this delta function that appears here for this EX or Y. And notice something, this thing is not well defined. If X is equal to Y, this is a distribution, this is a complicated object in some sense. Whereas here, I have this function, which is a concrete function, which is an element of this space, and it is perfectly nice, perfectly regular. Okay. So comments. So these phi x and pi x are real functions in phase space. The Poisson bracket is also a real function in phase space, which in this case is very simple. It's constant. It doesn't depend explicitly on phi or pi. Okay. And notice that even if I put x here and here, I get something which is what you find. Whatever you get, if you plug x in the formula that I wrote before, okay? So, of course, there are some differences in the usual case. For example, this Poisson bracket here will never be zero, but this is something that you have to cope with if you want to work with a particular Lagrangian or theory defined in this space, okay? Now, let's compute the Poisson bracket with the other function, with the one that was not vegetatively differential, that was defined with an integral with derivatives and so on. Now, you can do the computations in a very, very similar fashion. It's a very simple exercise. For example, this partial evaluation of the Poisson bracket of this with V, which is a function of phi and pi, that is writing here this argument, can be computed in a line, and in this case, it's very easy to see that it is zero. If instead of computing pi with v, I compute the capital pi with v, I get the computation is completely anomalous, and I get something which is non-trivial. It is different from zero, and now this depends on phi. So I genuinely have a function in this phase space, okay? And as you can see, I mean, we give many details of these computations in the paper, so you want to check them, just go there. There are really no abstractions to perform these computations. In this one, for this family function, which was not a vegetatively differential, is as easy as computing the one of these partial evaluations that I wrote. Okay? So it's actually very, very easy. So you can in fact check that the result that you get here is a differentiable function in this space. So you can plug this into the Jacobi identity if you want to compute to check the Jacobi identity. Okay? And the way you see that this is differentiable is just by writing it as the composition of the first projection with this function here, which is linear and continuous, and then is differential. Okay. So I will finish now. Let me just make some final comments. So first lesson that I learned by looking at this is that despite what we all have been taught, the transit from mechanics to theories is not as straightforward. It can be done. There's nothing terribly subtle in there, but you have to be careful. You have to be careful with some issues related to the functional spaces where you work. The configuration spaces for field theories
carry really important structures that play relevant roles. In particular here, for example, for this solid space that they have introduced, the scalar product, the particular form of the scalar product, is very important. Okay, and you have you have to compute scale up that you have to discuss part with the products or the hits and part with the derivatives. Now, these solar heat spaces that I introduce here as some kind of device to make actual computations in a concrete example. are actually very nice spaces because you can use the derivative and you have a scaling product. So an interesting question that I pose to all of you, which I call the big question as well, is it possible to define interesting and useful fields in this space? Because if you can, then of course you can do concrete computations in a perfectly rigorous way without running into any kind of trouble, okay? You will not have these issues with violations of your community or having to split deltas and things that you see when you do computations, for example, with the flux and a lot of variables in a naive way. Of course, if you do them in the right way by using these parameterizations or so, then everything is perfectly fine. But if you just try to do like computations, then you will run into trouble. If you are working in these kind of spaces, you will not find any problem like that. This is the paper that we wrote about this. You can find it in the archives. I finish here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Fernando. First, let's see if there is any student that has a question.
I have a question. So, what happens in some cases where, in order to have, well, in the usual picture, where you take the functional derivative and you want the variations to only contain bulk variations of the fields without boundary terms.
Okay, yeah, what they call regulator in functional differentiation, right?
Yeah, so that, I guess, is assuming that the symplectic form is only integral over the space, the bulk without boundary terms.
What happens there? Well, That is not the kind of functional differentiation that you have to use if you are computing the canonical Poisson brackets. So the dependent, and then, for example, if you look at the formulas, if you look at these, the standard ones, this one here, for example, there, in practice, you are acting as if you were using L2 scalar product. Okay, and multiplying this function. So the first term can be interpreted as the L2 scalar product of these functional derivatives. But why are you using an L2 scalar product if your configuration space is not L2? And then if you are working with usual theory, L2 is not a very good space because you cannot even write the derivatives, for example. So what kind of action would you write there? So the point is that, as I said before, the radiator kind of functional differentiation is not what you need to use in the canonical to compute the canonical possible. It's this other expression. Okay. So what happens is that you can get anything. I mean, but it's not really what you're.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I think I didn't ask my question clearly.
Okay, I cannot hear you very well.
Yeah, so I'm asking what happens with when the fields, if you allow non-trivial variations of the fields near a boundary, sometimes you may need to add a boundary term to the function.
I cannot hear you very well. I mean,
is asking what happens if you allow the variation of the field to be non-zero close to the boundary.
Yeah, and so in our in the usual formalism, you usually had to add a boundary piece so that the variations of those boundary pieces cancel the bulk variation. Sorry, cancel the boundary variations coming from the bulk variation.
So he's saying that usually you add a boundary term to your action to take care of this term that you might get while varying the action. So I have like boundary contribution to the action.
I'm asking how what happens in your formalism situation?
Yeah, what happened in your formalism when you have such a boundary term to the action?
Okay. I have not worked with a particular action here. I have only done some computations in this kind of space, okay? So now, of course, if you want to do dynamics, you have to introduce a Lagrangian and an action, and your action may have boundary terms and boundary terms, okay? That's perfectly fine. When you compute your Lagrangian equations, you will generically get bulk contributions and boundary contributions. And of course, you have to be careful because when you introduce your space of fields, you may require your fields to satisfy some boundary conditions. So the boundary conditions that you introduce in your space of fields have to mesh nicely with whatever contributions you get from your Lagrangian equations under the boundaries, okay? So that's perfectly fine. So if you give me a configuration space, a particular configuration space, then if you want to do Poisson brackets, you have to build the random model. You have to tell me how the duals that you have in the fibers work. And you have to use the kind of formulas that I'm giving here to compute the Poisson brackets. So there's actually no the particular action that you're using is not relevant in the sense that when you want to compute Poisson brackets, it's actually just the canonical syntactic structure that you have to use. And of course, so for example, something that some people do is the following. Some people say, well, when you write a syntactic form in this way, you may have boundary terms in the
Because here you may also have a boundary in sigma, so you may have some contribution of the syntactic form under the boundary. The right way of looking at that is, again, looking at the canonical syntactic form and interpreted as sigma is done, because in terms of the dual log, yes, you have your fibers in the boundary. I don't know if I can answer your question now. Yeah, it's... yeah, so yes. So we have another question by Bianca also has a question, I think. Yeah, but yeah, it's just we start by the student and after we go to others. Okay.
Okay, but now the scalar object is a solid space, for example, because here the derivative should be covariant, right? Okay, but now the scalar object is a solid space, for example, and now you have to write for me an action for self, for chain simons, in this solid space, which is written in terms of the lateral objects that we have there, for example, using the scalar product in the solid space. That is the contribution. So it's not that you are taking the usual chain simon action and proceed. You really need to write the action in terms of the lateral objects in the solid space, and then go ahead, okay?
So This is not a formalism, this is the standard formalism, and of course when you want to apply to concrete models, you really need to give me the Lagrangians, build the actions, show me that the dynamics defined by those actions is the correct one, and then once you have that, then you just follow the usual steps. So this is not a different formalism, this is the standard formalism, right, interpreted in the correct way. But again, if you want, even for the scalar field, I mean, not just some science, you want to do this for the scalar field,
It is actually non-trivial to write an action in this sublevel space that gives you the dynamics of a serial feed. So that is why I have finished my talk by saying this big question, okay, which is, well, can you really write actions in these sublevel spaces that define interesting theories? Because if you try, it's not that straightforward. Okay. And it may happen that no such good actions exist in this particular sort of space. Okay? So that doesn't work. But what I'm trying to state is, in an ideal world, the kind of things that you have to take into account to be sure that you are doing the computations right. And this is not a different formalism. This is actually the standard formalism, the canonical formalism. Correctly interpreted, taking into account functional analytic issues. In one concrete example, for example, in
sublevel
spaces, which are
very nice.
Okay.
Go for it, Bianca.
Hi, Fernando. I have two questions. One is just a fast clarification. So in your example, the fields did not need to satisfy any boundary conditions.
No, they are just elements of H1.
Of H, okay. So, The second question is, what about if one goes to a quantum field theory? Where in quantum field theory, at least for a scalar field, you know, we like our delta function in the Poisson bracket.
Yes,
it's a pi x as a derivative. So will that be more complicated, or does actually this funny curly E function help to write a representative, I mean, a quantization for the momenta, for instance, or?
That is a constant function because it doesn't depend on the fields. So yeah, I think that for quantization, it should be as easy as dealing with the delta. Probably easier because it's perfectly integrated. If it depended on the fields, then it would be completely different. But it is independent of the fields.
So you don't expect, okay. And then do you expect that it helps with regularizing like a Hamiltonian where you have a product of fields appearing?
Yeah, my hope is that if you can find nice actions in sort of spaces, what you would have is a very regular kind of theory. You will not run into some of the problems that you run in the standard formulation. For example, here, for example, you have problems in two multiply distributions, which happens in quantum field theory, but in this kind of spaces, you just have functions which are regular. So the multiplication is well defined. It's a Lagrange algebra size. So my expectation is that if you can write actions in these kind of spaces, which gives you the dynamics, interesting dynamics, quantization should be much, much better. So this type of sublevel space may actually provide some type of regularization.
Okay, but did you possibly talked already, can you write a free scalar field action on your interval?
It's not that easy. If you just take the standard action, you can write it in terms, you have a term the L2 scalar product of the velocities minus the L2 scalar product of the derivatives, the gradients, and then if you put the master, you will have another thing. But then, if you are working in some of the space, that action actually is not good because the field equations would involve second order derivatives. And generically, the elements in these kind of H1 spaces don't have second order derivatives. So, A straightforward action doesn't work. You have to do something else. Okay.
And H2 or something is not, it doesn't help.
Well, no, it doesn't help. I mean, because at some point you need to have all of the derivatives, and if you try to do solar spaces with the infinite number of derivatives, then that's a problem. Those don't work.
Okay.
So it's not that straightforward, but I think it's not impossible to get something which, if it is not exactly the standard scalar field, it's very close to it. And I'm looking at that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I don't have a question.
Hello.
Hi, but isn't then that a motivation to go beyond subolive spaces and look into Fréchet spaces and stuff, which is harder, and then Poisson geometry is difficult in there, but maybe that's a price to pay to do field theory. Not every function would be Hamiltonian in a Fréchet.
You may have all sorts of pathologies. Okay? Yes, absolutely.
Any other question? But let's thank Fernando again for his very nice talk.
Okay.
Thank you, Fernando.
Sorry?
Thank you.
Thanks to you. Thanks for it.